The personal brand to me was just, if we can make ourselves known, not just as a faceless, nameless, new technology company, but as these people that come from the industry, that care about the industry, that have this experience, then it might be easier to have people care about what Quotebeam is doing.
Welcome to Manufacturing Happy Hour, the podcast where we get real about the latest trends and technologies impacting modern manufacturers. Happy Hour. Each week, we interview industry experts that are at the top of their craft and give you the tools, tactics, and strategies you need to take your career and your business to the next level. And now, your host, Chris Lukey.
Hey, what's up? It's episode 179. Today, we're discussing the power of personal branding and building trust with your ideal customers. Our guest this week is Nikki Gonzalez. She's with Quotebeam. She's a co-host of the podcast Automation Ladies. She's around the manufacturing industry quite a bit. And if you don't remember, Quotebeam was on the show right around 2 years ago. We had their founder, Roman Piech, on the show. And just as a quick refresher, Quotebeam is a platform that brings products from a bunch of different supply chain sources to one place to help customers source their parts. They're making a big splash in the industry right now. And if you haven't checked them out, make sure you do that because they're just one of many topics we're going to talk about on today's episode. So here are a few things you can expect. First, we're going to hear Nikki's story, and we do this a lot on this show, but we're not just talking about Nikki's career journey here. You're going to be hearing more about that coming right up here at the start of the interview. Second, and this is a big part of our conversation, we talk about personal branding. And for a little bit of context, Nikki and I were just on a panel a few months ago where that was the topic: how can companies leverage employees with strong personal brands? How can employees work with their companies to make it a win-win, you know, for an individual to grow their career, but also leverage their voice to help the company grow? All of those are topics we cover in our discussion. So this part's a bit more of a two-way conversation versus, let's say, a one-way interview. Then finally, we talk about Automation Ladies. We get caught up on Quotebeam. So full episode from start to finish. If you want to learn more, head to the show notes page by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/179. And the only announcement I have today before we dive into the interview is Automate 2024 is coming up. If you're listening to this episode right around the time it's coming out, that event is taking place in Chicago, May 6th through 9th, 2024. It's hosted by the Association for Advancing Automation, and it is the event to be at if you are in the automation or robotics world. I'm going to be there. This event used to be a biannual event. It used to be every other year, but hey, there's so much going on in our industry right now that it is now an annual event. So make sure you register for free by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/automate2024. And hey, I've mentioned this before, but if you want to be part of conversations, if you want to be part of interviews like the ones that we do here on Manufacturing Happy Hour, I'm going to be part of the Automate Live team. So when you go to the website, if you want to sign up for an interview, make sure you look that up. We would love to have you in the lineup. Anyway, manufacturinghappyhour.com/automate2024. We hope to see you in Chicago. And with that, let's jump on in. It's time for a long conversation with Nikki Gonzalez. Nikki Gonzalez, you and I have had plenty of opportunities to hang out in real life, occasionally over a beverage, but since our conversation is virtual today, if we were having this interview over a drink, where would that be?
We'd probably be at St. Arnold's Brewery in Houston, out in their beer garden, or maybe looking at the art cars in the parking lot.
I love that answer. For context, for anyone listening, St. Arnold is basically a beer cathedral in Houston, Texas. I was there, I was living there 2011 to 2015. They were kind of the original craft brewery in Houston, but they since expanded and I have been back a number of times. And that is an excellent spot for this conversation.
For sure.
So big fan of that spot. They don't brew a single bad beer, and they definitely brew some beers that are good for the Texas heat. So we are recording in March 2024, but let's say we're doing this in the heat of the summer when those beers, I think Weed Whacker, Fancy Lawnmower, those are a couple of the refreshing ones they have over there. Let's say we're drinking a couple of those. My first question, I think absolutely warrants a good story. What was it like spending your childhood in Iceland, a place that is significantly different from Houston, Texas?
Yes, very different. I grew up in a small town of about 16,000 people. In a country that total, you know, population is about 350,000 people. So, you know, my world was pretty small, although Icelanders are pretty good about, you know, we have to have international relations and travel outside the country anytime we want to do anything significant. So we are pretty open from, you know, our perspective, learning about the world. But at the time when I was growing up, nobody really knew about us. We didn't have, you know, a volcano erupt that everybody knew about, Eyjafjallajökull, and things like that happened yet. So I guess I'll say I had a really idyllic childhood in a place that was still small and safe. And, you know, I could run around outside. I was taking the bus by the time I was 8 years old, being able to go downtown and go to the pool and things like that. I had a significant amount of freedom compared to what it would be have been like growing up in the U.S. Although that I think that varies a lot between communities, right? One thing that's so different is the U.S. is so giant, it has all kinds of things to offer.
Do you have any memories you can share of when you first, because you moved to London for a year, I think, and then you moved over to Houston. Any of, maybe culture shock isn't the right word, but what were those feelings like? Okay, so what was the culture shock like going from one to the next to the next?
Yeah, so my dad's an electrical engineer, and he got involved in some international projects, which pulled him to work for a British company. He wanted to move to the U.S., though, but this company had a branch in Houston, and he had to go work over there for a little while first in order to be able to get his visa and everything in order for the position in Houston. And so we lived south of London in a small town south of in Surrey in the U.K., and that was different for me. Speaking English, which was not my native language, although I was already starting to learn it just from subtitles on TV. Going to the UK, it was still Europe. It was still a small place and it was safe. And I, you know, went to take the train places with my friends and I had a fair amount of autonomy. One thing I experienced there that I was different is I had to wear a school uniform. You know, you learn to adapt and ask questions and figure out your environment. I was 11 at the time. And thankfully, I had some experiences traveling abroad when I was a kid, so I'd become comfortable with being uncomfortable, let's put it that way. Having to, you know, and my parents didn't always do things for me. So when I was new there, I had to figure out how to learn things, how to ask for help. And then I came to Houston, and I felt like all of my autonomy was immediately just stripped away. Because I moved to the suburbs of Houston when they were still being developed. I was in middle school at the time, so seventh grade, not the best time to be different and try to fit in. And really, it was that car culture that really got me. I was not able to do anything on my own without my parents and other people's parents orchestrating things. And that was a big shock for me. And I actually really hated it. I tried my hardest to get my parents to change their minds and move back. And I really held on to that past of mine. You know, I used to have such a good life. I used to have such good friends. Why do I have to be here? Why is this so terrible? I also moved from, you know, if you think of how in the U.S. you're in elementary school, you have all your kids in your class and you spend all day with them and you have one teacher. That's kind of how the European school system is up to, you know, older ages. And then I got thrust into middle school in the U.S. with seven different periods in a day, all new kids in every class. All new kids in the lunchroom, and I had a weird accent and a funny name and weird clothes. I didn't know it was taboo to wear the same clothes until they were dirty. coming from a place where everything is imported and expensive, I didn't have, you know, 30 days worth of clothes to wear. So it was a big shock to me. I went from being, you know, comfortable, carefree, kind of autonomous kid to all of a sudden, you know, being cooped up and having to try to make friends, being different, I basically spent quite a few years watching cable television after school because all of a sudden I had 100 channels and no friends instead of tons of friends and no TV. So it was a big adjustment for me.
And now that this is over 20 years in the rearview mirror, what would you say you learned from that? How did that experience shape you into where you are today?
I think it really made me fearless because I realized I did change that situation around. Nobody changed it for me. I tried to convince my parents to move. I tried to be as miserable as I could so they could see that we needed a change. None of that worked. And I was just getting more and more miserable myself. And I don't remember what the catalyst was specifically, but I remember people making comments like, oh, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, nothing is wrong. They're like, oh, you should smile more. And at some point, even though I thought that that was kind of dumb, I started to try to fake smile at people and be more outgoing and, you know, kind of that Americanness that I saw. And at some point, I realized I was the only one that could change my attitude or affect it, right? My circumstances were not going to change, so I had to do something about it. And so by the time I got to high school, I changed my attitude. I changed how I approached being there, and I decided to try to make the best of it. And I really, through that experience, I also learned that a lot of my peers had not had those types of experiences, they relied a lot on other people to do things for them, whereas I became kind of fearless in figuring things out myself. So the other thing is my parents had no experience with the education system here. I couldn't lean on them to know what to do. So I learned very quickly to find resources, ask for help, learn things, push for myself. And I think that that's made a big difference in, you know, my career as well, because I found those opportunities where people need somebody that is kind of willing to do new things or learn something along the way. And I think a lot of that had to do with my childhood experiences.
And I'm hearing a theme of figuring it out, a theme of self-reliance, which I think is appropriate for another question I wanted to ask you is you left the education system and got into your career. Tell us the story of how you, let's say, accidentally made your first sale while you were working for your dad.
Yeah, so being an immigrant, I didn't have the ability to just go get a job at a grocery store or, you know, something that like the kids at my school were doing because I didn't have a work visa. So my dad let me come work in his small business. So his story, he came here for that company, but they actually ended up shutting down their Houston branch. And my dad is entrepreneurial, so he just decided, hey, I'm not ready to leave. They offered him to go back to the UK, but he had bought a house. We were settled here, so he started his own business. And I started working in his business well before the legal age. I might have been 13 or 14 when I started kind of interning for him. And he just, you know, it was for him just to help me get some experience, earn some money. So he would just pay me out of his own pocket. But I basically started interning there every summer, and I would work there on holidays and things like that. And it was a small business, so there was a lot of things to accomplish, and I got to learn a lot of different things. I started out writing manuals for the touchscreens and the systems that he was building, and then I started writing tech spec sheets and then marketing material. And I just kind of, you know, every summer would try to take on another thing and another thing to try to learn more aspects of the business. Because I also figured, hey, this is my only place I can work. I better learn a lot of different things here. And I started to help with reception. I would answer the phones. And we had salespeople at the time. And I remember one time an inbound lead came in. It might have been from one of our marketing activities. I used to send out brochures and qualify the leads by calling ahead of time. And I picked up the phone and it was a company in Washington State. And our sales guy wasn't in. He might have been at lunch or something. So I went and asked, hey, what should I do? And the office manager at the time, Chastity Morey, she just said, hey, just run with it and ask for help if you need help. You know, we can tag in the sales guy anytime, but just go ahead and figure out what they want. You know everything we do, so just go for it. And I was able to actually take that lead, work with them to configure what they needed in their system. So this was tracking for trucks. At the time, before cell networks were really good, there were areas of the country where, you know, you wouldn't be able to reach somebody by phone. So we had satellite systems that would track the trucks and things like that. And I just ran with this, and we actually went to my first trade show during that time, which was the Great American Trucking Trade Show in Dallas. And I remember being in the hotel doing a remote demo of the system to this company in Washington before we went to the trade show floor. And we closed the sale. I can't say I was like a great closer or anything. I felt like I was just helping. Yeah. And when I needed somebody else, I would tag somebody else in, and I turned out I didn't need anybody else. Because this wasn't, to me, it wasn't selling. It was just me trying to problem solve for this customer and show them, hey, oh, this feature actually does do what you need. We can solve your problem, which their problem was during on their routes, there were areas where they had no coverage and some of their trucks were, you know, the data was inconsistent. So they bought this system and then they actually emailed my dad sometime after and they didn't know that it was my dad. We have different last names and stuff. And they said how happy they were with the process and specifically with me and how I, you know, got them everything that they needed and they were really happy with it. And I just thought to myself, wow, that wasn't as hard or weird as I thought sales would be. And these people are really happy and that made me really happy. And that kind of opened my eyes to the fact that technical sales is a thing in and of itself. That's not sales and it's not engineering, but it's somewhere in between. And I really found that to be something that I enjoyed.
Yeah. And you have a lot of experiences in your career so far. So I know we're not going to get to everything today, but you started, you know, about the first 5 years of your career were in sales and industrial automation with Keyence and Festo. And I think most of our listeners would be very familiar with both of those organizations. What I'm curious about is why did you decide to make the jump to software after being in that space for like 5 years? And ironically, I think you've kind of jumped back a little bit since then. Are you kind of merging yeah. together? We'll get to that later. But why make the jump to software at that stage in your career?
So it was partially by accident, like many things. My whole career has kind of been a series of open doors or windows that I didn't know existed that I decided to go through. I did not have this grand plan. I've never really known what I wanted to do exactly. I knew I wanted to do business, but I love problem solving, right? So technical sales came up for me, and Keyence, wonderful company that recruits out of college no matter what type of degree you have. Because I did find myself with a business degree being, you know, I couldn't apply for most engineering type jobs because I didn't have an engineering degree. And I loved technical sales. Factory automation was fascinating to me. What I didn't love, and I was living in the Bay Area at that time, was mm-hmm. when I looked at the people ahead of me, whether they were the sales managers or the veteran, you know, outside sales guys, they weren't necessarily healthy. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure some of them are very happy, but I can see that that lifestyle, that takes a toll on a person. And I also saw that, hey, you know, a lot of them, thankfully, had bought a house back in the 80s or in the 90s. Here I was in the Bay Area in the 2000s. And I just thought, I'm never going to be able to afford a house. The industry just doesn't pay well enough. And it didn't seem like a lifestyle that I really wanted for myself to be on the road all the time, you know. And so when the opportunity came to me to sell software, I thought, this is it. I had thought about it before, but I had no idea how to get in, right? Because people look at your resume and they say, you know this, right? What do I know about software as a service or any of these other things? I actually got lucky and an incompetent recruiter called me and didn't know the difference between electromechanical and electromagnetics. And he sold me on a job to sell electromagnetic simulation software. And I thought, this is super cool, but I have no idea what it is. And I had to educate him on how it was different. But then I said, you know what, though? This is really fascinating. I would love to sell this. I doubt this company wants me because I don't have that experience. But if you want to present me as a candidate, I said, my skills are, I'm a quick learner. I know the industrial industry. I know how to work with engineers. I know how these things are made once they've been designed, and I would love to learn it. So I was like, if you want to tell this company that and they still want to interview me, go ahead. And they did. And I, to this day, don't know how that lined up to where, you know, they were willing to take a chance on me. And they, I guess they demoed it to me in the meeting, in the interview. It was a very long interview. And then the next day I got the job. And it was fantastic. It was my favorite job for a very long time after that, because I got to work with PhD engineers designing products that I used to see being manufactured. And I'm such a nerd for looking upstream and downstream at the processes that I touch that it was a real treat for me to get to move into the software space.
Well, one of the things that sticks out about that story is you've described your career as a handful of it's been a handful of accidents that have gotten you to some pretty interesting places. But you did set some expectations there on saying, hey, this is what I can do. And if you still want to hire me after this, you know, you weren't faking it at any point, like, to get there. You were setting those expectations. Now, another transition in your career, which brings you to where you are today, is, as I understand it, you first met Roman, the founder of Quote Beam, where you are now, who's been on this show before. Gosh, it's been maybe 100 episodes ago, but you met him when you were at Festo. So tell us the story about how you came across him and maybe how your paths crossed again to get you into the current role that you're in.
Yeah, it's a big lesson, I think, on networking, even for me, and relationships just throughout your career. You kind of never know where those relationships are going to take you. And the time that I met Roman, I was a sales engineer, a key account sales manager in the Bay Area. And Roman was on the engineering side. And we sold together this project. It was a great application. But it wasn't very smooth. I'll put it that way. I was not used to selling engineered systems. So it was a big lesson to me in sort of the life cycle of an engineered project. And I will say it was a rocky project. We got it done. But there were a few things that nobody foresaw. And we had to learn, you know, kind of you go through the fire with someone, right? You know how they work under not perfect circumstances. Anyway, that just forged a good connection for us. And I ended up leaving Festo, and Roman ultimately ended up leaving Festo and going to Apple. But we stayed in touch. LinkedIn, I'm sure, is the way that we were able to, you know, stay in touch with each other, which is just a fantastic way to keep your network when people move companies and things. But I ended up going into a startup that was doing AI and supply chain. And Roman went to Stanford, and he had met the CTO of Quote Beam, Andrew, there, and they started working on this class project. And at some point when he was at Apple, we decided to grab lunch down in Cupertino, and we were both geeking out over AI and what it was doing and wasn't doing at the time. And we stayed in touch that way. So he kind of clued me in on what he was working on, and I thought it was a really cool idea. And it took several more years, and, you know, he stayed at Apple for 5 years. I did a bunch of other stuff, but we just kept that kind of professional connection going. And I came down to speak at a conference in the Bay Area, and he saw me. No, I mean, it was, again, kind of a series of happy accidents. We had both got invited to the same AI conference by the same group of VCs from Stanford, where we ran into each other after not having seen each other for probably 2 or 3 years. We found out that we had both had a baby on the same day. And, you know, there's just like sometimes those things just stack up until you go, okay, I can't ignore this. We have to work together.
Yeah. Well, what I heard is, at least in that instance at Festo, was that you learned how you each worked together under pressure, which is a great thing to have under your belt before you're on the same very small team at a startup, as I know Quote Beam is still considered.
Next round of our interviews coming up right after a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Swipe Guide. Swipe Guide is helping frontline workers perform at their best through standard work instructions and skills development. Their clear-cut platform lets frontline teams coordinate instructions, job aids, and training to optimize processes. All of these aspects add up inside of a manufacturing operation, keeping motivation high and operations running. I mean, Swipe Guide is right in line with one of our biggest themes here on Manufacturing Happy Hour, empowering frontline teams. Their customers are saying the same thing. Here's a quote from a recent review. Swipe Guide has been fantastic for empowering our operators. They now have all the information and knowledge they need to do their jobs at their fingertips. Plus, if you really want to hear how Swipe Guide is making a difference for manufacturers, then head back and listen to episode 167, where Swipe Guide CEO Wilhelmine Schneider and Joris Stolk from Heineken jump on the show to discuss how Swipe Guide's impacted their global brewing operations. If you're a regular listener here, you know that talking about how technologies apply to brewing is certainly one of our favorite topics on the show. And you can get to that episode by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/167. If you're looking for a hassle-free solution for sharing how-tos and boosting know-how across frontline teams, then look no further and head to swipeguide.com today. And now, back to today's interview. Let's get into, you know, you mentioned LinkedIn. Let's get into the topic of personal branding now, because you and I, you know, a little over a month ago before this recording, you and I were on a panel at the Industrial Marketing Summit, specifically on personal branding. And I think you're a great example of someone that has found a way to continue to strengthen your brand while strengthening the brand of the company that you work for. So can you share a story of how building a strong personal brand has created a win for you as well as Quotebeam?
Yeah, I started with Quotebeam and I came back to LinkedIn, and LinkedIn, I found you, right? And a few other people that were doing something with the personal brand. Before when I was active, it was really more for recruiting and jobs and maybe keeping in touch with colleagues or people that have left jobs to try to get back in touch with them. And I started seeing more content, which I thought was fantastic. And just thinking, okay, if I'm starting a business now, and this was, 2021, what are the future ways of marketing? Because things like this always change. You know, the only constant you can expect in the world is that it's changing. So I like to look at trends and try to think, okay, how can I get ahead of something instead of being the last person to catch up on it? And I saw you and I saw Megan and Chris and Jake and see, I've said this enough times that I include your name in there, even though I'm talking to you.
So Jake Hall, Megan Zimba, other past guests of the show, just for anyone that's listening and has that context. Yes. So no, I appreciate that.
I just thought, you know, if there's one trend that I can go in on as a new company thinking about how do we market ourselves in the future, not so much influencer as much as just realizing that network effects are real. And we are a technology business, yes, but this industry and most other industries are the backbone of that. All of that business is people, right? People relationships, right? How did I get hired to Quotebeam? It's because Roman knew that he could trust me under pressure, right? If I had presented him my resume, he would have been like, who is this? And absolutely not. And I've learned that in sales as well. A lot of it is about solving the application, but a lot of it is that people can trust, that they can rely on you if something goes wrong or how you react, right? So the personal brand to me was just, okay, if we can make ourselves known, not just as a faceless, nameless, new technology company, but as these people that come from the industry, that care about the industry, that have this experience, then it might be easier to have people care about what Quotebeam is doing and who we are, marrying our personal strengths and stories with the business. Because Roman has had the idea for Quotebeam since he graduated from school. I mean, it's been a long time in the making. And I saw the power of the content that you guys were putting out. And I thought, okay, if there's one thing I can bet on, I think that it's the power of these personal connections. Because the other thing is, the world is full of options now. We have every piece of information at our fingertips, and yet just so much of it is just information, right? How do we provide context? And there's 100 companies that do similar things. How do you, you know, aside from having the best tech or the most money to spend on advertising, how can you differentiate yourself? And I just thought this is one, I think this is the way to do it, was just my kind of personal bet. And I thought, and it's great because it doesn't necessarily require lots of money, which we didn't have at the time. We were pre-seed round. It was three of us, very little resources, very little budget. So I thought, I know this is going to take some time. It's not something you build overnight. It's not something that you pay for. Even if we had the money, you can't really pay for this stuff exactly. But I just thought I have to start early and I have to start now. And it has. So to answer your actual question, how has it helped Quotebeam? People knowing me helps me open the door to people hearing about Quotebeam. And sometimes you got to lead with whatever will let you open the door. And I don't believe that today that's cold calling and trying to get past the gatekeeper to tell somebody my pitch on the phone, right? I want it to be a warm introduction, somebody that believes that I'm somebody with value. And I want that to translate to the company as well. Because we're still a startup, we're early on, we're building something. So we can't come right out of the gate and say we have the perfect product that does everything and that's better than every competitor and every other option. No. But what I think is we have the team, we have the skills, we have the experience, and we have the right motives in the industry to build this. And I want, you know, people to kind of come along on the ride.
Yeah, I think at least a theme that I picked up in that answer was trust. And that was a word you used a couple times. It was what I thought was interesting when you were talking about sales, you very easily could have talked about how it's based on relationships, which I almost thought you were going to use. But I think the whole time you use the word trust, which I think is the right way to go, because at the end of the day, back when digital personal brands weren't as much of a thing as they are now, trust was based on relationships. And what I see now and what I feel like I learned from your answer is that trust can also be built on those gradual interactions over time when your personal brand is front and center, and it gives you that trust when the door is already cracked open for Quotebeam. My next question on top of that is, why do you feel some companies fear then when an employee has a strong personal brand? And to make it actionable, what steps can they take to start seeing the individuals with strong personal brands as an asset rather than a potential threat?
I think it has all to do with culture and ego, to be honest. And I might not be giving the most palatable answer to companies that do have feel some kind of negative way about this. I think that people or organizations, if they're afraid of their employees eclipsing them or leaving them, like, I think a lot of it is, oh, we invest all this money in you, and then if you get too big, you'll get recruited away. Or the fear could be, well, you could be out there representing our brand and then do something dumb, and now it's going to reflect badly on us. Both of those are absolute possibilities. But I think, again, the word here is trust. If you're not an organization that believes that your employees are valuable and that you can trust them to fulfill their duties within their job and to act in your company's best interest at all times, then having people with personal brands probably won't be a good fit for you, because they won't feel safe. They won't feel like they can grow with you. So I think there is something to say. Not all companies should embrace this either. You might need to take a serious look at your culture and see if you want to change it for this to be a thing that could work for you. Because it is a two-way street. You have to have trust on both sides, for the employee and for the employer. And I think that that takes a certain type of management style or an organizational culture that actually believes in, you know, that their employees have some autonomy and that everybody is kind of part of the same mission. If you feel like, you know, your employees could say something about you that isn't good, then you're probably not in a good position to market yourself this way at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate the blunt, honest answer in that capacity. I think that's what people need to hear. And I do think that's a great first step, that when you talk about, hey, how do I leverage the personal brands of the individuals that work for my company, you probably, as the owner or the leadership team at that organization, need to take a look in the mirror and say, hey, are we fostering the type of culture that's going to result in a positive perception of our company from the folks that work here? So I certainly hope manufacturers are getting better at moving in that direction, where leadership can say, yes, we know we're doing the right things. We trust our employees, and these folks can speak out. On the flip side, then, how can individuals with strong personal brands do a better job of collaborating with companies and ensuring they're in sync on the company brand? I think that's a big question for a lot of folks as well. And since you just gave a very blunt answer on, hey, what do companies need to be doing, let's talk about the individuals that are working there as well. What can folks like you and I do?
I think getting buy-in is really important, right? You can go out on your own and do all kinds of stuff, but if you do it completely without discussing it with your employer at all, then I think you're probably setting yourself up for some sort of conflict down the road. Because you might have your colleagues that are close to you that you work with every day, you know, love what you do. But then at some point, at the bigger you get, right, the more attention you get, it'll get in front of more eyes. And then if you're at an organization where that may not be a good thing for you, that, you know, they can shut you down, right? I've had people that did this kind of on their own, right, without their employer's consent. Then their employer came down and said all kinds of things. Oh, you're doing, you know, breaking non-competes. You shouldn't be showing this. You shouldn't be presenting this. Take your stuff down. You don't want to put in all that work and then have, you know, end up in some sort of conflict with that. So I think, again, if you do have a strong personal brand, think about where's the synergy? Because the other thing is, if you're have a day job and your personal brand is just for you, that can also be okay, but I think there has to be an understanding then. Your employer is like, yeah, we know you do this on the side and it's your thing. We don't want anything to do with it, but that's fine. Or if you can actually have that conversation and say, hey, I really have this passion for doing this stuff. I want to get my content out there more and I want to do it to help both of us, right? Then you can have either a formal plan or at least an understanding that there's a conversation that can happen there so that if conflict does arise at any given time, you need to be able to just work through it. And so it has a lot to do with trust, and that's a two-way street. You also want to make sure that your employer trusts that you're not just doing it for yourself to then get the heck out of there as soon as you get big enough or whatever that is, right? So for me, you know, I get asked sometimes, am I trying to be the next Jake Hall? And for me, that's not my goal. That's not why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm not trying to become a full-time speaker, which I think is great. It's a great goal for some people, but it's just different. And, you know, Quopium knows that. That's not what I'm trying to do this for. And so we all feel comfortable. And then we're also comfortable talking sometimes about, hey, before you go on this podcast, like, you know, make sure that you don't, I mean, we don't really have like things like that, but let's say like a product launch, right? Make sure you don't talk about that until we're ready.
Right. Yeah. No, everything you're saying makes sense. Synergy, I think, was the key word there, right? Because having a personal brand, the Venn diagram of what a company does and what a person does, there's only so much overlap, right? So part of the personal brand is going to have nothing to do with the company. And that's okay, right? We're all human. We're all multifaceted. But I think being honest with one another about, hey, where are the synergies? And getting some buy-in, you know, when I started manufacturing Happy Hour, one of the first people I talked to was my immediate manager. You know, part of it was just saying, this isn't going to cut into any of my day-to-day responsibilities. And, you know, I just want you to be aware that, you know, I'm doing this for the customers I work with today. And, you know, as easy as that, right? It doesn't need to be a daunting conversation. It can be very much, hey, because at the end of the day, you and I both know this, when you start leveraging your personal brand, it usually starts off pretty small and pretty slow. Like there's very little to be worried about at that stage. But yeah, synergies, getting buy-in, great points.
We'll be back in a moment, but first, a quick word from our sponsor. Are you looking for some manufacturing entertainment? Then you need to check out 3M's Clash of the Grinders Student Edition Competition, which you can do today by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/3M. This web series pits soon-to-be pros against each other in a showcase of the next generation of skilled trades talent, and it all culminates with the winner receiving a $10,000 scholarship sponsored by FANUC. Throughout the series, you'll see the competition, manufacturing trends these emerging leaders will face in their careers, and how new innovations will help them work more efficiently and sustainably. 3M is committed to skilled trades education with a goal of creating 5 million STEM and skilled trade learning experiences, and this is part of that mission. Make sure to subscribe to 3M Abrasives on YouTube so that you don't miss a single new episode of Clash of the Grinders Student Edition. Again, manufacturinghappyhour.com/3M will take you right there. And now, back to today's episode.
We're a little over 30 minutes into this conversation, and that probably means it's time to get a refill of some St. Arnold Amber or whatever's on tap there at the brewery today. But I want to ask you about Automation Ladies as well, which is another part of your personal brand, which has some synergies and has some unique elements to Quopium as well, right? Not all of it overlaps, but how do you describe what Automation Ladies does as if you're having a beer at St. Arnold's?
It's a show where mostly girls talk about automation, not only to women, but mostly. Yeah. So that's my, I'm still figuring that out in a nutshell. And it's actually grown. It started out as just a podcast and we have started doing other things, LinkedIn lives, doing interviews at shows. It's kind of just grown in and of itself. Like most things that I do, I didn't have a grand plan of exactly what Automation Ladies was going to be. It was me and Allie. We were talking about how we both would love to see more content by women in the space. And we tried to get other women to do technical content. And, you know, people are too busy or this or that. We tried to encourage other people. And then I realized I'm a big proponent of, if you're going to complain or bring up a problem, you better bring a solution to the table as well. And I don't like to complain and not do something about it. So we kind of talked about this. We're like, hey, we think this is a problem. We want to see somebody solve it. We tried to get other people to solve it. They didn't. And so we just like, let's do something. And I actually thought of the show because I love the show Office Ladies, which is Angela and Pam from The Office. And they're best friends in real life.
Okay.
And they like all to talk about The Office. And so I thought, how cool would it be if I had a best friend that I could talk about automation with? Because trust me, none of my friends and family want to hear about my my automation stuff. And that's really kind of how it started. And we found ourselves to be growing. We found so many cool women in the industry working all kinds of different jobs that we would never have met otherwise. That I always say, too, with Allie, like, even if we never published a single episode of the show, just doing it, just the women that we've gotten to talk to and connect with, has been amazing. We were just recording a podcast with somebody from Ireland earlier today. She's actually from Brazil and has moved to Ireland. Allie and I actually met on LinkedIn, and then just be able to connect with not just... Okay, so I want to say this. People confuse us a lot with women's industry groups or nonprofit groups or advocacy groups or educational groups, which we are none of those things, right? Automation Ladies is a podcast / show.
It feels kind of like a club. A little bit, right? Like, you know, people in industry are identifying with it. At least that's some of my perspective.
Well, we are actually, so you'll get the scoop here. We're starting a Discord community because there are just so many people that kind of want to stay in touch with us after the show. A lot of our community members that haven't even been on the show, but they show up to listen, they engage. We want to find ways for us to all collaborate just as a community, because finding other people in the industry that are as interested in collaborating and lifting other people up as we are has been fantastic. So that's kind of what Automation Ladies is all about. It is not just for ladies. We just happen to be the hosts are ladies, and that's where the name came from. But we do try hard to make sure that we are exposing stories and giving people the use of our platform that maybe wouldn't be invited onto other platforms. Just because that's kind of our space that we occupy. But I personally have been to a lot of women in engineering and women in this meetings, and it just wasn't my cup of tea to be thrust into a room with a bunch of other women. What I realized when I met Allie is I just needed other women in automation that I had something else in common with. And you just never know kind of who's your cup of tea, right? And now with the internet, you can find people that resonate with you.
I didn't realize it had... some roots going back to The Office and Office Ladies. I love a good, the audience knows that I love a good pop culture tie-in. By the way, if you're listening to this, check out Automation Ladies. If you like Manufacturing Happy Hour, you'll like Automation Ladies. And as you said, it's not just for women, it's for allies, other folks in the industry. Thinking back to your answer there, a couple of the things that stuck out, and this is a lesson I always try to tell people. You made the comment of, if we never published an episode, it would still be really valuable because the connections we're making. And that's one of the things I try to tell people all the time who are thinking of creating content or starting a podcast or any sort of medium where it's interview centric or connection centric. And I tell folks, it's like, look, if you're doing this for your business, like, feature your clients, feature people you wish were your clients. So I think you made a great point there in terms of the networking aspect. The other thing I'll say is, just so for the folks out there that might not be familiar with Allie, Alicia Gilpin, founder and owner of Process Automation and Controls LLC. Did I get that right?
Process and Controls Engineering LLC.
Process and Controls Engineering LLC. I will have the link to it correct in the comments. That's my fault. I'm sorry, Allie, if you're listening to this.
Because I've been mentioning, we have a friend, David Turner, that owns a company that is called Process and Automation Specialists. And I've gotten it wrong like three times because there's something about those. They're very common engineering words. And there are many companies with those words and some different combinations. And I have a really hard time keeping them straight, so I don't blame you. But PCE is what we call it for short. Obviously, you kind of have to care about, you know, to be able to use the acronym. But Process and Controls Engineering, that's what, yeah.
And I will have the correct link to that in the show notes for anyone that's curious. So, you know, we're getting to the end of the conversation, but I do have a couple more questions. And, you know, we'll go back to one of the themes of the interview so far. How has Automation Ladies impacted your personal brand? And then, you know, you kind of talked about that already, but let's say the QuoteBeam brand, if you can talk about that, since this started fairly independently of it, but I could still see areas where it would tie together and make an impact.
Yeah. So as I was thinking through how I can utilize social media and personal brands to help QuoteBeam, we didn't have the budget back then to engage with influencers in a formal way. So I thought, hey, I want to try to just add value to these people, because in my, you know, experience as a salesperson, if you lead with value, you know, you usually get something in return later on. You just can't expect it right off the bat. There's a book called, I haven't actually read it, but called The Go-Giver. I like that message, right? And so I started to do the same, and I came across Allie and I started interacting with her. She was building her, she has a demo kind of tower behind her that she calls it's not the Turbo Encabulator, but whichever is the official like Rockwell parody.
The Retro Encabulator, yeah. The Retro okay. Encabulator.
Yep. So hers is called the Turbo Encabulator. And I was just early on, I followed her and I thought, hey, do you need something else for your demo? You know, QuoteBeam is a new site. We help people with finding components. What components do you need? And let me just send them to you. And so that's actually how I ended up starting the show with Allie. We really hit it off. And when I thought of who would I like to talk about automation with on a show like Angela and Pam, Allie is the first person that I thought of. But we did start this independently. At the time, I told Roman, I was like, hey, I really want to start a podcast. I was like, with this person, she'd probably say no, but like, would that be okay with you? And, you know, it might take some time. And he was like, oh, yeah, totally. Sounds like a great idea. You go do your thing. Like, he's always been a great supporter of women in the industry, especially after he worked at Apple. I think he touched on that in his episode with you. And so he was just very supportive from the beginning. But we didn't really tie any direct relationship between QuoteBeam and Automation Ladies, other than he let me kind of have free rein in deciding when I spend my time on it. So I do record during the workday, right? But I also work late many days. So we have this trust relationship that I can do things like that. And it's funny, QuoteBeam logo is now purple, the same as Automation Ladies. So I, being a scrappy person, I just like threw some stuff in Canva and I was like, hey, this is a rough draft. What do you think, Allie? And she just thrust it out into the universe and Automation Ladies became an official thing. I designed all that stuff in Canva. None of it was supposed to be official. But when you build something, you just got to go with the MVP sometimes. It grew faster than I expected, but it probably had a lot to do with the fact that Allie also had a large following and we did a great job just engaging people in the community with it. It has really helped, like I said, open a lot of doors for QuoteBeam. QuoteBeam is an official sponsor now, but I wanted to be careful about it initially to make sure that especially people coming on to the show knew that it was not some sort of corporate effort on QuoteBeam's part to, you know, just market themselves. Like, it really is authentically me and Allie and what we want to do. And over time, they've kind of merged more together. I actually went on vacation last year for 3 weeks and came back and we had changed our logo to purple. It had nothing to do with me or Automation Ladies. But I think that's kind of part of, now I realize, like, my story is, a lot of it is just kind of like, oh, that's cool, that happened. Yeah. I didn't plan it that way, but it did. And it just so turned that we had hired a bunch of designers and they were very strong about wanting to stand out in the market. Our old logo was, you know, safe blue, and they wanted something new and different because we are new and different. And it turned out that the purple thing went together. And so we've now started to do more things hand in hand because they've really seen that the show helps with relationships that sometimes have benefit to QuoteBeam. Sometimes they don't. So we just did a live last week with Linda Freeman from Rockwell Automation. It was a fantastic show. Somebody that was in the audience, based on Linda's direction to say, hey, connect with people that are in the audience of the show, sent me a LinkedIn request, and guess what? It's a distributor, and a distributor that's a great fit for working with QuoteBeam. But I couldn't have planned that. I can't say that the show, you know, automatically generates these leads or anything, but I think just my openness and my I hate to say this myself, but my authenticity of people really, when they talk to me, it's very clear that I don't really have an agenda. I kind of you know, I really am. I come across as I am to people. And I think that that allows that element of trust to open up pretty quickly when people see, like, hey, what you see is what you get. If you meet with me in person, over Zoom, on the show, it's all the same. I'm that person. And so if you're comfortable with me, we can probably work together.
Yeah. No, a couple things that stood out in that story. One, extremely tangible example of how your connection with your guest, Linda Freeman, who, by the way, was, as a side note, my industry connection into the amusement and attractions industry. For anyone out there, she has one of the coolest roles where, as an automation leader at Rockwell, she has served the amusement and attractions industry for the longest time. So we bonded over that. But my main point I was making there was that that is a very tangible example of how your podcast got you in touch with a distributor, one of your ideal clients for QuoteBeam. But I think one of the things you said earlier was maybe equally impactful. You started this on the side. You talked to Roman. You talked to the founder of the company you're at and said, hey, I'm going to do this. It doesn't have a lot of overlap with what we're doing at this time, right? But I think that also almost makes it more authentic where, as you built it up, as you turn it into more of a legitimate brand, QuoteBeam could look at that and say, you know what? This is something we want to get behind. And I think it's, you know, it's almost stronger than a company like QuoteBeam going out and starting their own podcast. And the fact that the logos are now both purple, even more convenient, right? So,
yeah, people do associate them. But I agree with you. And people do ask me about podcasting as well. And I think people connect with people more than companies. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to start, a corporate podcast, by all means, I think that's great, like having those conversations with your ICP. But to me, I thought, especially because QuoteBeam was such an unknown brand at the time, if I had started a QuoteBeam podcast, who would have cared? Who would have listened? Like, I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a fair comment to make, right? Like, it's you got to find a solution. You got to find something, a topic that's addressing a challenge in the industry, and you got to make it entertaining as well. And I think you did the right thing with Automation Ladies, right? Like, you had an audience. You know, when you hear the name, you're naturally going to attract women in industry, which is a great way to start growing the following to begin with. I do want to bring it back to QuoteBeam for the last question, because we've touched on QuoteBeam and we have an episode further back that'll be in the show notes as well, where we really got more into it. But how do you describe QuoteBeam as if you're having that beer at St. Arnold? Last time I'm going to ask that style of question. And then what's new at QuoteBeam?
So QuoteBeam is a procurement platform for the industrial automation industry. It's a little bit hard to describe because a platform encompasses many different things, just like a system, right? QuoteBeam.com as a website right now helps people find parts that are in stock. So we went and talked to a whole bunch of different companies in the industry during the pandemic, and their number one problem that they were having in the, engineering and parts procurement and building was getting parts because they were out of stock. So that thankfully has changed a little bit now, but some of the dynamics, that change is not going away, in that people have now been conditioned to go look at the internet when they don't get the answer they want from their primary supplier right away. There are certain types of buys that just require immediate convenience. So what we're doing is bringing together the solutions providers in the industry that provide value-add services and technical expertise and great customer support, all the wonderful things that regional distributors do for their customers. They stock inventory for their local customers that they need. We're not trying to disrupt that. What we actually want is to help those distributors put their non-allocated inventory that they have available for sale and make it easy for companies that really need that inventory to find it and buy it. Instead of just having to have, on the one side, you have very technically competent, wonderful solutions providers that are local. And then you have a catalog house on the other end, just somebody that you can go to Amazon or not to put these companies down. They have great selection, like a McMaster car. Everything is easily accessible on the internet. Our industry traditionally has not been. Uh-huh. It is challenging for many, many different reasons. But what I'll say is that it is one of those problems that it doesn't make sense for any single supplier to tackle alone. And so we kind of came in and built this platform that is meant to make it easier for customers to collaborate with their suppliers and to be able to find the products that they need quickly and buy them. we've kind of become well known as a second or third source if people are having trouble getting what they need. And so we help our customers, our distributors, their panel builders, their systems integrators, their, you know, everybody in the industry, because if you just need something, we can help you get it. And that is the first layer of the platform, because that was the biggest problem that everybody had at the time, and we wanted to solve it. If we're going to come in and offer value, we can't just come in and say, we have this great idea, we're going to build this thing and you need it. No, we asked, what do you need? And functional e-commerce and, you know, automation in the back of the house for distributors, all of these things are things that we are doing that they need. It just wasn't the first thing that they needed. So we started with the first thing that they needed, and now we're building out more and more portions of the platform. So something that is coming out, I'll give a little pre-release note, I guess. It will probably be officially launched right around the time that this episode comes out, or maybe shortly after that. So if you're listening to this, you're getting a little sneak preview. But because our customers are regional distributors, is one of our ICPs, really, is we want to help the regional distributor with the tech in the back of their house, and in the front of their house, really, the website part of it. We built this platform for us. We built our own chat because customer service chats don't work for the type of work that we're trying to do. We built our own quoting system. We built our own marketplace system. We built our own data for the products, all this kind of stuff for QuoteBeam. And then our distributors are, you know, they're working with us and they're going, oh, man, our e-commerce is hard. We have all these different disjointed systems and they don't talk to each other. We need our orders to go to our ERP. Can you do what you do for you? Can you do it for us? And it wasn't our plan. And we've pivoted many times since we started. But one thing that we take from our background, and especially in, you know, in automation, you really have to work with the customer to build the solution that works, that solves their problem. And so we actually are rolling out a e-commerce platform for distributors that they can use on their own websites to take all the learnings, all the tech that we've built over the last couple of years, and apply that for themselves. And then we really want to help those distributors grow, not just through our platform, but on their own as well.
Well, I know this is coming out right around the time that that release is coming out. So whether it's a week before, a week after, I will be linking up to QuoteBeam, so that way you can find them. I'll be linking up to connect with you as well, Nikki. I just want to say thank you so much for spending a couple rounds at St. Arnold Brewing with us today in our little virtual beer hall. Appreciate having you on the show.
Likewise. Cheers, Chris.
Hey, hey, I hope you all enjoyed that this week. So first and foremost, I'm going to let you know here in the outro that the solution Nikki was talking about, it's called Sales Pilot by QuoteBeam, and that is now out. They just had their virtual product launch. So if you're an industrial automation distributor aiming to boost online sales, improve customer engagement, hey, check out QuoteBeam, and while you're at it, make sure you check out Automation Ladies. Nikki and Allie G do a great job hosting that show. And by the way, I'm sorry again for screwing up Process and Controls Engineering LLC. That is Allie's company, so I will link up to that over in the show notes page. Speaking of which, manufacturinghappyhour.com/179 is where you can go to connect with Nikki, subscribe to the Automation Ladies podcast, and of course, there you can get more information on one of my favorite breweries, St. Arnold in Houston, Texas. Okay, as we wrap up, thank you to our sponsors this week, Swipe Guide and 3M, as well as the Association for Advancing Automation. They are hosting Automate 2024 in Chicago on May 6th through 9th. And if you're in the robotics industry, if you're in the automation space, if you're trying to learn more about machine vision, artificial intelligence, this is the event you need to go to. I'm going to be there. I have a blast every year I go. I'm going to be helping out with the Automate Live interview. So if you want to sign up to be a part of conversations like the ones we have on Manufacturing Happy Hour, get your story out there, broadcasted to many automation leaders, sign up for those. Go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/automate2024 to sign up for the event, sign up for your Automate Live interview. We hope to see you there in Chicago. The final thing I'll say, if you want to join a club of other manufacturing leaders, go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/community. That is our group on LinkedIn. It's a private group. It's kind of like the Manufacturing Happy Hour listener community for all practical purposes. It would be great to have you as part of the discussion. I try to start weekly discussions around all the topics we talk about on this show to get other people collaborating, meeting one another, and helping one another solve the biggest challenges we're facing in the manufacturing industry on a regular basis. Join the Manufacturing Happy Hour industry community today. Shoot me a direct message on LinkedIn so I know who you are, that you heard about it on the podcast, and we will let you right into that private group. Anyway, that's it for this week. Stay innovative, stay thirsty. We'll catch you again here on Manufacturing Happy Hour real soon. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Manufacturing Happy Hour, powered by the Industrial Network.